Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Omaha Town Hall Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by former Chief Steward on Air Force One, Howie Franklin, who served five American presidents, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. Mr. Franklin also serves as president of the North Carolina Airport Association and as director of the Brunswick County Airport in southeastern North Carolina. He has written of his experiences in his book, Yes, Sir, Mr. President, My Life Aboard Air Force One. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, March 25, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Town Hall, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Betsy Strain, president of the Omaha Town Hall Board of Directors.
Howie Franklin's 29-year career in the Air Force included 18 years as flight steward on Air Force One. Because of his dedication, discretion, and reputation for providing good service with a smile, he has the very unique distinction of serving as flight steward for five consecutive U.S. presidents. He also flew exclusively with Secretary of State Henry Kissinger on shuttle diplomacy missions. Mr. Franklin has a special affinity for Omaha and Nebraska because during the fourth year of his Air Force career, he was assigned to Offutt Air Force Base and served as a flight attendant to many, including the generals. Mr. Franklin is currently the director of the Cape Fear Regional Jet Port, which is also known as Howie Franklin Field. His book, Yes, Sir, Mr. President, will be published later this spring. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Howie Franklin.
Thank you. Hey, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back in Omaha. I want you to know, I want to thank the people here and the people of Omaha. In 1969, when my friends and I returned from Southeast Asia and we went to other cities and other airports, we were spit on. But when we came to Omaha, Nebraska, we were treated as Americans. And we'll never forget it as long as we live. And we thank you for being who you are. I'm going to be a little risky and ask a question. And if we don't get anybody, that's fine. But while I was here in 1969, we lived in a house, five of us Air Force guys lived in a house on off 33rd Street near the Mutual of Omaha building. And we used to go to a place where I still always remember. It was a sing-along bar, well-lit. And when we went in there, you know, people, I would say, where do you go? And they said, go to this place called Bill Bailey's. Really? Well, you know, I said, when do I go there? They said, well, you need to go there Thursday or Sunday night. Is that correct? And they said, I said, well, when do I have to get there? They said, you got to get there at 5:30 to get in. You know, I wasn't used to going out till 9:30, you know. Went there, and I remember, and to this day, I'm still a big Red fan because of that place. They start out, the band came out, and I was a little surprised because it was a tuba player, a piano player, a banjo player, and I think a drummer. And they were older than we were. And they'd start out playing the national anthem. And everybody stood up. I remember I came from other places where we were spit on. And then they played the Big Red song, fight song. And then they played the Iowa fight song, which I thought was very civilized. And then they played the anthem for all the military. They played the Coast Guard and the Navy and the Marines, and the last one was the Air Force. And to this day, my friends, we always talk about it. It was wonderful to come to this wonderful place in Omaha, Nebraska. But it was the most delightful place to meet people I've ever been in my life. And it wasn't a sing-along pizza place. It was a sing-along bar. So you guys remember it. That's fantastic. Thank you. Howie Franklin, I got the opportunity. I'm the only one in the world that worked for 5 presidents consecutively without getting fired. Now, a friend of mine worked for President Johnson, and according to stories, he was personally fired 8 times, but he got hired 9 times. And I was very lucky that didn't happen to me. The presidents I worked for, of course, was President Ford, President Carter, President Reagan, President Bush, President Clinton. He's guilty, but he's a nice guy. Believe me, very nice. Now, I also worked for Vice President Ford. When he was vice president and Nixon was still president, I flew with him as an Air Force Two. And then after he became president, I flew with Nelson Rockefeller on Air Force Two. And now prior to the Ford and the Rockefeller administration, I flew with a gentleman that you probably remember, Spiro Agnew. And I happened to be on his last trip, which we didn't think it was his last trip. We were in Chicago, the crew, Air Force Two, and we were watching in the morning. He was speaking to some group, and he said, "I'm not guilty, I will not resign, yada, yada." We returned to Andrews Air Force Base, and I looked out the window, and they were tearing the furniture out of the Air Force Two office. I said, "That's not a good sign, you know." So I also, as I said, worked with Dr. Kister, and he was the greatest trainer I ever had in my life. If you can work for Dr. Kister, you can work for anybody. He was tough. He was good. He expected everything, but including the best in every way that you can give him. Under duress, long hours, whatever it was. And I was young enough to be able to travel with him and keep it up. A mission would be Andrews to London, spend the night. The next day would be in Moscow in the morning. The afternoon would be in Tel Aviv. That evening we'll be in Aswan, Egypt, and traveling all over the world like that. Now, Dr. Kister he paid me what I consider one of the better compliments I've ever had in my life. He came back after traveling one time with him around the world, and he looked up at me and he said, "You know, Howie, you treat me better than an old Jewish mother." And that is a compliment. I want to first of all tell you, Air Force One's major mission, the primary mission of the president's airplane and the crew, is to provide secure and safe air transportation for the president, the staff, and everybody that travels with them. First goal, secure and safe air transportation. The second one is to try to provide all the services that we could that the White House provides for the president only as we travel throughout the world on the airplane. Now, my job as the chief flight attendant on the airplane, my goal was to try to provide a professional but comfortable atmosphere. We worked very diligently, my flight attendants, male and female, and everybody that bought into that. And in other words, we want the passengers on Air Force One, when they return to that airplane, if they're in Red China or in South America, when they walk on the airplane, I want them to feel the way you're going to feel this afternoon when you get home to your house. And we worked very diligently at that. Sometimes we got too successful because we couldn't get some of the presidents off the airplane. So a little show and tell on the airplane and a little history. The airplane, President Reagan, he wanted to order a 747, but he never saw the opportunity because they came out in 1969 when he was president. President Ford wanted to order a 747, but he never saw that window. And President Carter wanted to order it. So President Reagan is the one that ordered it for the presidency. And he ordered it the first part of his second term. And after he had ordered it, one day I was in a conference room and I overheard him say, "You know, if I knew I was going to win with such a great landslide, I should have ordered it the first term." On the airplane, the decor of the airplane was picked out by Nancy Reagan, and she did a wonderful job. Of course, she had some help with people in Los Angeles, and in the design and things of that nature. But I heard a story, a gentleman who was in the Air Force, a colonel in the Pentagon, and they were going to come up with some color schemes on the airplane. And they had the Air Force colors. They had gray and blue and light blue and dark blue and everything like that. And they had some nice examples of it. And they went to Nancy Reagan and they showed it to her. And she looked at it very nicely and she said, "That's very nice, but don't you think it should be a desert motif?" It's a desert motif. And it still is. So she must have did a pretty good job. The decor is basically the same as it was when the Reagans ordered the airplane. They never saw the airplane. Mrs. Nancy saw the airplane the first time. It was when Ronald Reagan passed away. So, but anyway, if you go in the front of the airplane, there's a private area for the president with two couches that pull out into bunks. And then they're comfortable bunks, not like your fold-out that's uncomfortable for your neighbors, you know. They're comfortable bunks. And then there's a desk in there that the president and the first lady can share across the table from each other. You go from that room, then there's a bathroom. Bathroom has two sinks and a shower. That 747 is the first Air Force One ever have a shower on it. And they don't take that for granted. They appreciate that very much. That means when Richard Nixon flew all the way to Red China, he went to work without taking a shower. So they really enjoy that. Then they go to the stateroom, which we consider the Oval Office for the president on Air Force One. And that's where he conducts most of his business and brings up guests and things of that nature. From there, we go towards the back and we have a medical annex. Now, in the 707, we didn't have any room for that. The 747 provided some room for us, so we were able to, it's about a 12 by 12 room, medical annex. Now, in the 707, traveling throughout the world, you're going to get sick. Sooner or later, the doctors were always very busy. You pick up something. So that they would have to administer to you in the fuselage of the airplane with everybody else. But with the 747, we could have private doctors working and taking care of you. From there, we got the front galley, and we also have a back galley. Front galley, we serve about 100 people. That's including crew. And I want you to know that they all pay for their meals. I wrote a bill out for everybody. I would go buy, if I was buying a breakfast for 100 people, I would divide that by the number of people that I bought it for, and if you ate breakfast, I'd give you a bill. If you ate lunch, I'd give you a bill, the same bill, and the bill would have lunch, snacks, beverages. So everybody on the airplane pays for their meals. And the reason is they're all on per diem. That means they're getting paid for that day, so why shouldn't they pay for their meals? There was a time during the early Nixon days that the White House picked that up for everybody, and then when he got indicted and things of that nature, they started getting real straight, and they realized they shouldn't pick up the meals, and they charge people. I actually remember going to Key Biscayne on the backup airplane and going around and collecting 68 cents for snacks. So they went to another extreme, but my goal, as far as the meals are concerned, they're family meals, homestyle, like you'd go to a homestyle restaurant here. And that's because we're billing them for their meals. They don't necessarily want to have an elaborate big meal. Now, once in a while, we will for a special occasion and things of that nature. But we got dinged once in a while by the press plane, because the press plane, the passengers, the press that fly in the press plane pay three times a first-class seat to fly in that airplane. So it's very common for me to have a day where I have a breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the 100 people. And I talked to the press, the gentleman who's running the press plane. I said, "How much you spend today?" He said, $6,800, and I'm spending $1,500. So there's a difference in the quality of the meal. And that's because that's what they required, things of that nature. And the other goal was that the first meal that went out to the first person and the last meal went out to the last person was at the same quality. We worked very diligently on that. Everything's handmade. Everything's hand-shopped. We shop in civilian clothes. We can't cater anything. You can't. All the dishes are done on the airplane. They're all washed. They're bartended. Everything is done on the airplane. okay, so then we go from the galley area to the VIP guest area, not the VIP, it's a cabinet level executive staff place, room. It's got four chairs, and the chairs are very comfortable. They're sleeper chairs, and if it was the Secretary of Defense who was riding with us and he wanted to do paperwork, he can turn to the bulkhead, hit a button, and a desk, a platform will come down that he could use for a desk. So all four of them have desk capabilities. and it's for cabinet-level people. From there, you go back to the staff area, working staff area. There's several tables and chairs around, and four chairs around each table. And so I'll give you a secret that they don't know on Air Force One. The crew knows, but the passengers don't to this day. The tables go up and down. Well, we never told them because we didn't want them to put their feet on the tables. But the table will go up and down and make it into a coffee table and things of that nature. From the working staff area, we go to a communications area. From the communications area, we go to a VIP guest area. That's where the congressmen, senators, and VIP guests would ride. Then the Secret Service area. All the Secret Service that's traveling on the airplane. Then the press area is in the back. So the Secret Service is in between the people, the guests, and the press. The protocol on the airplane is when you come on, you have a seating assignment, somebody escorts to your seat, and the protocol generally is that you're allowed to walk, as long as the seatbelt sign's off, from that seat aft anytime you like. For you to move forward of your seat, you should be asked. That's just to keep some organization. You can understand, otherwise people will be running all over the place. Not that they always do it, but we try to do that. And the other thing I'd like you to know that you may be happy as taxpayers, the press pay a coach fare to fly on Air Force One, plus a dollar, plus whatever I served them in meals. So it's not a free ride altogether. We basically became, as far as the food business on the airplane, we were fairly self-sustaining on the airplane. Now, the wonderful presidents I worked for, as I said, I didn't work for LBJ, thank God. And, remember I said he ruled through fear and intimidation? His pilot was Colonel Cross that made general. His pilot was the only Air Force One pilot in history to ever get promoted to one-star general. George W. tried to promote Colonel Tillman to one-star, but the Congress stopped it, so they weren't. General Cross is the only one. Now, General Cross and I stay in touch with him. He's getting older right now, but he reminds me from time to time. He said, "You know, Howie, he promoted me to general." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "But you know, he always called me major." And so that's, you know, fear and intimidation. So, anyway. First president I worked for, of course, was President Ford. And I found out while I was here, another wonderful piece of history, he was born in Omaha, Nebraska. You know, that's fantastic. Homespun, down-to-earth Michigan family. I mean, as down-to-earth as you can get. And the other thing is, because of his situation, he didn't have the ego of an elected politician because he was appointed. He was appointed to vice president. He was appointed to presidency. But he took his job and is very serious, and he was always very cordial. He shared with me what I used in my career, a wonderful moment in a education in community and communications and people skills. Early when he was campaigning actually against Ronald Reagan for the Republican ticket. And the Republicans at this time, as the Republicans do and the Democrats do, they were fractured. And he was trying to bring the parties back together. And he came back on the airplane. It's the President of the United States and me in a stateroom. And, of course, we knew each other from Air Force Two. He always used to, he'd once in a while, grab my jacket and say, "Howie, you remember I got here first." Anyway, he said to me, "You know, Howie," he said, "there's only one way to conquer your enemy." And I said, "What do you mean, sir?" He said, "Well, if you fight your enemy, the fight can continue. You kill your enemy, it continues and continues. But if you can make your enemy your friend." He said, "Now, you don't have to sleep with them. But if you can make your enemy a friend, you can conquer it and get some more things done." And I took that for heart, and probably it helped me in my career. After the Ford administration, of course, the Carter administration came along. My first experience working with wonderful Southern Gentile people, President Carter, you know, was an engineer. And, you know, you guys know engineers. They can't help themselves. Yeah, they're wired a certain way. You know, go to an engineer's garage. I bet he's got it categorized, organized. You know, that's the way it is, and that's the way they do it. And he took a little heat for that by They said he was scheduling the tennis matches and things of that nature. But he was an engineer. He was a very good educator, and we enjoyed travel with him very much. But I spent a lot of time with Rosalynn Carter, the First Lady. And now when the president flies, he's on Air Force One. That's the airplane that the president's on. When the First Lady flies, she flies in a squadron airplane, and the call sign will be Executive Foxtrot, the tail number or something like that. She's not flying on Air Force One because the president's not on board. And if you remember, during the end of the Carter administration, the Ayatollah had our hostages over in Iran. And uniquely enough, 6 months before the hostage incident happened, in January 1, 1979, I was in the palace of the President Shah, the Shah of Iran, with President Carter for a celebration. 6 months later, the embassy fell. Anyway, President Carter was driven to get our hostages released. So he did not want to, he campaigned very little. He did campaign, but very little. He trying to get a hostage release. He sent out Rosalynn Carter. She did a lot of campaigning all over this country for the president. And one of the more touching moments I remember, it was in February. I was on a campaign trip. We're going to Maine. The First Lady's going to do what the politicians call pressing flesh. That means they're going to go out, shake hands, and try to get people to vote for her husband. And we go to the first stop, and it's 26 below zero, as you're not familiar with. But anyway, I remember in Omaha, I never forget this one, the news reporter or the weather reporter said the high for the week was 6 below. Anyway, it was like 26 below up there, and I go to help this First Lady on with her coat. She's got a heavy fleece-lined coat. It comes from Afghanistan, actually, and they're full length. It weighs about 10 pounds, fully fleece-lined inside, and then suede on the outside. And it was a kind of a chocolate brown, very nice. Well, I go to help this wonderful, gracious Southern lady, and I can't emphasize that enough, on with her coat. I'm standing behind her, and she slides her hands down in the coat, and I'm standing directly behind her, and she accidentally hits me right in the groin. Now, I mean, it was a direct hit, sports fans. And she knew it, and I knew it. When we looked at each other, a lot of nonverbal communication going on. And I can't, this wonderful, gracious Southern lady, I mean, she's looking at me, and I know, you know, it was a whole paragraph she was giving me, you know. You know, I wish this didn't happen, and I'm going, yeah, that's right. You know, she was embarrassed. Now, no one else knew about it. It was her and I, but she was embarrassed, and I don't want to embarrass the First Lady, and she was being gracious not to embarrass me, but I was embarrassed as well. Returned from that mission that night, I came home and I shared with my wife, and that's when my wife said, well, that was a touching experience, you know. Two days later, I'm out on a campaign trail again, whether we're going back up to Maine. It's now 24 below zero. Now, when I go to work, I'm focusing on today, not what happened yesterday. Well, what happened 2 days ago? I got to focus on today. I don't know if somebody plays golf here, you hit a bad golf shot, one of the things, they just don't forget about it. You got to focus on the next shot. And that's basically what I'm doing on my job. My reputation's on the line. I have this mission and I got to run for this First Lady. I'm not thinking about the code incident. It happened 2 days ago. It's completely out of my mind. We stop at the first stop. I go to grab a coat. She's got a different coat. That's First Lady's got a different coat. I never even thought about it. So I grab the coat, and I come up to her, and I stand behind her with the coat, and she graciously turned to me, and she said, Howie? I said, yes, ma'am. She said, you notice now I have a caped coat? Here's a lady saw a problem and solved the problem. And I was very appreciative, very much so. One of the other memorable occasions I had, I was early on in the Carter administration, and Golda Meir, who was a former Brooklyn school teacher who became the president of Israel, passed away. And President Carter sent his mother as the head of a delegation on the backup Air Force One airplane. It's not Air Force One, it's one of the backup airplanes. It could be used as Air Force One if the president's on it. And it was Miss Lillian, and it was some senators and some White House people, some Secretary of State people, and a big delegation. Now, this is my first meeting with President Carter's mother, and she was a character. And I remember she came up to me. I remember President Carter, there was no drinking in the White House, no wine or whatever. Well, anyway, his mother came up to me and looked at me, and she said, "I'd like a bourbon and branch." Now, I'm from the South Shore of Long Island. I didn't know what branch was. Well, it's water. You know, branch of a stream, and that's a southern term, bourbon and branch. I found that out real shortly and was able to take care of that. Later on in the flight, I noticed that she was playing cards with the senators in the front of the airplane. And when she finished that, she'd go to the back of the airplane, play with the Secret Service, and she was taking everybody's money and just as giddy as can be. Giddy as she could be. And so anyway, we fed everybody, refueled the airplane and Madrid, and then we took off. It's 3:00 in the morning, body time. We're leaving Madrid and we're going across the Mediterranean heading for Israel. Well, by this time, very luckily, this wonderful lady had a relationship with me. And you know, she felt comfortable talking to me and things of that nature, which I was very appreciative of. And she came and sat with me on a jump seat at the back of the 707. There's a jump seat just by the door. This wonderful lady is sitting there with me. Has everybody heard of Billy Carter, correct? Okay. Well, anyway, she's sitting there and she says to me, at 3:00, we're tired. And she's not tipsy, but she had a few bourbon and waters. And she's talking to me about, she's still in awe, as you would be also, have her son being president. And, you know, how incredible this is. And then she says to me, and it's funny, Howie, because when the two boys were going to school, Jimmy had to work a lot harder to get the same grades that Billy got. I said, oh, dear. We all went on from the Carter administration to the Reagan administration. As you saw up there, I'm saying, what am I going to get here? And, you know, I knew he was a governor, and I knew he had pretty good stats because I heard California was in the red. When he left, it was in the black. I knew he was an actor. He was a B actor. But I'm interested, you know, is this guy really real? So I want you to know, I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I laid for this guy for 8 years trying to catch him being a phony, trying to catch him being insincere, trying to catch him being insincere about what he said or what he did or his attitude, and I couldn't do it. If I went in to give him something insignificant as a glass of water, he would do something, and he was genuine when he did it, non-verbally or verbally, to raise my self-esteem. That's a boss. I mean, you know, every time you get around this guy, it's like plugging you into a power cart. He gave you energy. He was incredible. Now, he had a great sense of humor. And the other thing is, I just want to remember, whatever I say about these presidents and first families and things of that nature has nothing to do with my political affiliation. It's my personal perception, other people may have their perceptions of the presidents and the first ladies. Anyway, Ronald Reagan loved California. We would get on the airplane and we were going to Ohio and he'd say, "Hey, Howie, we're going in the right direction, but we're not going far enough." And one time we were going to Texas, and he's running a little late, and he came on the airplane, and he said, "Howie." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You know, we're going to Texas." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "But they're taking me to a turkey shoot." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I don't know why they're sending me to Texas. I got enough turkeys in Washington." And he said that sincerely, remember. One time we were going to California, and And he was in the conference area. He was working on one end doing presidential work, writing his papers and things of that nature. The staff was on the other end of this small conference area, and they were doing their work. They finished, and now they're chit-chatting. And the discussion turned around to where, and they're going to do it someday. And this was back when Reagan was in office. Hollywood was considering at the time, and I know and you know they're going to do it sooner or later, making the life story of Mickey Rooney. And they were considering it strongly at that time, and the discussion within this group was, you know, about this possible movie. And then the discussion went to, well, I wonder who they're going to get to play Mickey Rooney, and a few names were mentioned. And then somebody in the group, now the president's not paying attention, or they don't perceive that. And somebody in the group said, hey, why don't they get Mickey Rooney to play Mickey Rooney? The president turned to the group and said, he's too short. And he would do that all the time. I'm going to, you know, he was a guy, as well as a president and a leader and things of that nature. On that last leg, and President Bush had been inaugurated, and we're going to California. I asked him to come up to the front row. Up to the cockpit and make the last landing in the observer seat. And he did say, you know, hey, George Bush is putting his clothes in my closet. Now, when he engaged the crew, the pilot, the co-pilot, the navigator, flight engineer, and myself, he engages you in a story, and you're going to listen to him. If you can imagine, this is Ronald Reagan telling a story, not me. And he's just sitting there, because there's a little time lapse. We're getting ready to land. It's out in front of us, but we're not there yet. And he said, you know, and he was, 79? He said, you know, the other day a good friend of mine went to this sperm bank and wanted to donate to a sperm bank. Now, Ronald Reagan's telling the story. And we go, yes, sir. He said, you know, and when he got there, the nurses were, he told them what he wanted to do, and they were a little concerned because of his age and everything, but they gave him a jar and something else and sent him to this room. Ronald Reagan's telling the story, not me, if you can imagine. He said, and he was in there for 15 minutes, and the nurse was getting nervous. You know, is he okay? And at 20 minutes went by, and she's getting a little more nervous. You know, what am I going to do? Finally, at about 40 minutes, he comes out shaking his head, and he walked up to the nurse. Ronald Reagan's telling his story. Ronald Reagan says, the gentleman said to the nurse, you know, I did everything I could. He said, you know, I hit it on the side of the sink. I ran it under the hot water. But I just couldn't get the lid off this jaw. And when Ronald Reagan told it, it was better than I just told it. You know? I want to give you two more with Ronald Reagan, and I have over 300 stories like this, and that I have in the book. But I'll tell you another thing about he's being a human being and a person. Charlie Palmer, who's the former chief steward on Air Force One, during the Reagan days, early Reagan days, we were going to Japan to a summit, and we were stopping and refueling the airplane in Alaska. And we were there, and President Ronald Reagan had a meeting with somebody and was going to talk to some people. So anyway, when Air Force One lands, it's going to block in at a certain time. They always say if they publish 2:00 in the afternoon or military time 1400, I guarantee you that airplane's going to stop at that time. So they were taxiing in. It was a long taxiway, and Charlie went into the president and the first lady. And the president said, hey, Charlie, give me my trench coat. And Nancy looked up and said, no, Charlie, get him the coat with the fur collar. Now, there's a problem, ladies and gentlemen. The commander-in-chief just gave an order to a chief master sergeant, and the first lady just overrode it. Well, the president immediately, he doesn't want to embarrass Charlie. And Charlie didn't want to embarrass the president, but the two men knew they were in trouble. So the president, him, ordered this, that, and the other thing about it, and then once he said, I may be overdressed if I'm wearing the coat with the fur collar. Nancy said, you're wearing the coat with the fur collar. So the two men, again, nonverbal communication. They know they're in trouble. The president wants to save Charlie's face. Charlie wants to save the president's face. But now they have resolved they're going to do what the first lady asked them to do. So the airplane comes to a complete stop. And Charlie's in there opens the stateroom door to let him out. And there's no time for chit-chat. And the president looked with his coat with the fur collar on, looked at Charlie and took his gloves and he said, "And I'm not wearing my gloves." And the two men were happy. The last one, Ronald Reagan, I shared this last night with the group. You know, I never saw him or witnessed anything in any attitude or any actions when he was president of his onset of his disease. He was the most civilized president we ever had in the sense that in 8 years we never took off any earlier than 9:30. And we landed somewhere around 5:30 for dinner and cocktails. That's some civilized flying, okay? But he was of that age group. You worked 9 to 5. And, you know, and when we went into these different economic summits, he was always fresh because of his work, what he did. He was ready to go. Anyway, John Boletta was his Secret Service agent when he was an agent, and he was his Secret Service agent when he left presidency. That one picture of me and President Reagan in his office, that was taken 2 years after he left office. So we spent 45 minutes with the president in his office, and it was the crew. They called up and said, "We'd like to see the crew," and he'd like to see the crew. We were there with President in Los Angeles with President Bush, George H. Bush. So we went up to see him, and I remember forget that day when we walked out of that office after 45 minutes in a room with this man, sharing and having a great time. New crew members that never flew with Ronald Reagan came out of there and they said, "You know, the man was excited about meeting me." You know, and I've met many people that met him on the rope lines. They've all said the same thing. Anyway, 6 months after that, his disease became obvious and more, and he was educated to it. He knew what was happening, and he was told what was going to happen, and things of this nature. Now, I want you to know, one of his passions in life was riding horses. And, of course, his passion in life was Nancy Reagan. I used to catch them flirting with each other. Very common. They weren't doing to impress me. They were flirting with each other. And it happened quite often. And but his passion was riding horses at the ranch. Well, John Boletta noticed as a Secret Service agent, it was getting to a point where it was a safety issue riding the horses. And we're going to have to curtail it. So he went to Nancy and he said, "You know, because of the onset of the disease, we're going to have to curtail the horseback riding. It's definitely becoming a safety issue." Well, Mrs. Reagan looked at John and said, "Well, you tell him." Which was probably the right call because, you know, they were professionals. One was Secret Service and one was the president, but they had a positive relationship. It was probably the right thing to do. John Boletta will tell you the story. He's walking through the park a couple of days later with the president. He's in tune. He knows what's going on. He's not having any negative actions or anything like that. And he turned to the president and said, much more graciously than I'm about to share with you, "You know, sir, the onset of disease, and it's becoming a safety issue riding the horses, and we have to curtail the horseback riding." John Boletta would tell you his first response was to console John Boletta for having to tell him that. Took away the passion of the man's life. And he was consoling the person that had to tell him that. That tells me loads about a human being. I'm not talking about his politics or anything like that. Of course, after the Reagan administration, we went into the Bush administration and the Bush family. And they're really family. And I want you to know Barbara Bush is the in charge. She's the cheerleader. She's the one that keeps them up and gets them going. And Mary Madeline, who does talk NBC shows, and she's quoted this many times, "The only one in the whole Bush administration that we respectfully, I want to emphasize, respectfully feared was Barbara Bush." I don't mean in a scary way. I mean, she expected you to be a professional. And if you didn't, she'll tell you how to get professional or where to go to get professional. And she was very good and very, very the cheerleader of the family. President Bush, you know, I can't tell you how much family they did. We would go to Kenny Bunkport and the whole family, the dogs, Ranger and Millie and the grandchildren and the kids were on there. Recently, I was speaking in Savannah, Georgia to a Georgian Airport Association. And I was waiting for an email to come in, and a gentleman walked into the lobby, and it was Jeb Bush. I thought it was Jeb Bush. He looked like him. Well, I know the gentleman, but he was busy, and I was just sitting there. Later on, I was the keynote speaker at this organization. I went upstairs, and I was dressed up like this. And, of course, everybody else in the organization I was speaking to were in golfing clothes because they're in Savannah. And when I went up to get something on this little food line, the lady said, "No, no, no, you're not here. You're around the corner." Well, I went around the corner, and I immediately knew I wasn't in that crowd. This was a high-rolling crowd. And I looked in the room, and I saw the gentleman again that looked like Jeb Bush. And there was a handler out front, and he was there. And I said, "Who is that?" And he said, "It's Governor Bush." I said, "Oh," I said, "you know, I used to work for his father, and I'd like to say hello, and I know the gentleman." Well, he was doing what he's supposed to do. I was getting more polite, and he was getting more resistant. And then Jeb Bush, maybe from here to a little past the piano, noticed me and came running out and came over to me and said, "Howie, what the hell are you doing here?" I said, "I'm here telling stories about you." He says, "What are you telling about me?" I said, "Well, we were going to Kenny Bunkport with the whole family and everybody was there. And on the couch outside the galley, Governor Sununu was sitting on the couch. He was chief of staff of the White House, former governor of New Hampshire. And Jenna, one of George W. daughters, is sitting on the couch. She's the one that worked for NBC News, but she was a little girl at the time. And I was standing there, and George W., the father, was standing there in the close proximity. And Jenna was playing with her tooth, and it was real loose. So Governor Sununu, who was a character, turned to her in front of her father and said, "You know, Jenna, if you lose that tooth and you put it under your pillow, the tooth fairy will come and give you $2,000. Well, Jeb Bush threw his arms up in the air and said, "Not in my family." I said, "That's what your brother said." He was, President Bush was a little bit, when it comes to athletics and things, impatient, fishing. If he went fishing, it's very common, he'd throw his line out 3 or 4 times, "Let's move," you know. And when the family played volleyball or whatever, they were playing to beat each other. It wasn't a good time. "I'm going to beat you." And he's been known, he played golf. It was very common for him to play golf and spend only 2.5 hours in 18 holes. You know, where it usually takes 4 hours minimum, you know. Well, he used to hit the ball and then he'd jog after the ball. And he, you know, and it was pretty aggressive. So we were in Bermuda with President Bush. We came in there the night before, and there was a girl that worked for me named Wanda Joel. Wanda Joel is a gorgeous black woman from Bermuda, and her father was one of the head pastors on the island, very well known. And she's returning home on Air Force One. She went in the Air Force. Now she's returning as a crew member on Air Force One to her hometown, Bermuda. And anyway, when we landed and we taxied up, the president looked out the window and it was more signs welcoming Wanda home. than they were President Bush. You know, and of course he queried me on that. I said, "Wanda, this is her hometown." He thought that was wonderful. But it was definitely, you know, with Wanda. Anyway, the first day we're there and it's April, early April, and in that time of the world, you can get one of those rainy days, which happened. But this day it was sunny, the first day we arrived, and it was, but the winds were blowing about 25, 30 knots. It was about 45 degrees, almost 50, and the crew played golf that day. And Bermuda, if you haven't seen it, it's very hilly. It's very up and down. It's extremely. It's not just a flat island by any means. So anyway, we played golf the first day. The second day, the day of departure, the president and his staff played their golf. Well, that day it was raining, 45 degrees, rain, winds blowing 25, 30 knots. That's got to be miserable, you know. So anyway, General Scowcroft, who's the head of National Security Council, retired four-star Army general, kind of a small-boned individual. He had his top coat on, and he come on the airplane after this golf game. Of course, they had changed and everything, and he was kind of chilly, and he said, "Howie, can you get me a hot tea, please?" I said, "Yes, sir. What seems to be the problem?" General Scowcroft said, "The man's crazy." This is our head of our National Security Council, and rightly so. He said, "The man's crazy." I said, "Sir, what seems to be the problem?" He said, "Howie, we just got done playing 18 holes of aquatic aerobic golf." And he said he liked it. Yeah. And he did. He liked it very much. So, of course, after the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, the Clintons came in. Now, President Clinton came in. His first president was 1 year younger than me. And we grew up in the 60s. And, this guy, he listened to rock and roll. And I welcome that. And I welcome that only because that I'm not saying anything negative. All the other presidents, including Nixon, historically listen to country music. And I like country music, okay? But they listen to country music, but they tend to listen to the sad stuff, you know? My marriage was a failure. My divorce ain't working out either, you know? So to have this young guy on there and he's listening to the Four Tops or the Beach Boys, it was fabulous. You know, he said, "How is this too loud?" I said, "We're waiting for a guy like you to come along for a long time, you know." President Clinton, 1 year younger than me, and he took a liking to me, and I took a liking to him. You know, you get around somebody, you can feel it. You either like somebody, you don't. And it was kind of like he needed somebody. I wasn't asking him for anything. And we used to joke around. One time, he'd say, "Howie, I need a favor." I said, "Sir, if you knew what we'd be willing to do for you, you'd get nervous." He said, "I'm already nervous." That time when we woke him up, and it's true, I went in there. That was a moment, a president's history. He went to his mother's funeral in Little Rock. He was very close to his mother. He was there 3 days, and everybody knows how tiring a funeral is. He arrives back at Andrews Air Force Base at 9:30 at night on a Gulfstream 4, which is Air Force One, because he's on that airplane. He arrives there, he walks off that airplane and walks around to the 747. It's 9:30 at night with the spotlights on it, walks up the stairs. The staff and the press and everybody is already on the airplane, and Ted Koppel's doing the making of a summit on the airplane. He's going to get interviewed. What I'm telling you, it's 9:30 at night. Is he taking his shoes off and going home? No. He's going to work. And I remember during that interview, Ted Koppel went through the whole airplane, and he talked to the president. You know how the press, sometimes they ask questions that may want to stimulate something or whatever? He asked the president, "I understand at your mother's funeral you didn't speak. Why didn't you speak?" And President Clinton answered the statement, "Well, I thought it was time for a son to be a son, not a president speaking at a funeral." And I tend to agree with that statement. Anyway, he's under the gun. He stays up late. Hillary stays up late. We put him to bed up front. Finally, Hillary goes to bed first. President goes second. I gave him 2.5 hours sleep. I should have gave him 2. But I felt for this gentleman, you know. And you usually get your best rest the last 3 hours of your normal sleep cycle. And I'm eliminating that. I'm blowing that because I'm waking him up 3:00 in the morning. See, now when Air Force One, remember when it blocks in Moscow, it's going to block in at a certain time. When I walked into that stateroom through the door, I had 1 hour and 30 minutes from the moment I stepped in that room to have them up, ready, dressed, meet the world press. And I probably should have taken a little bit longer, but I felt for him. Now, Mr. Stephanopoulos, what's his first name? George? Yeah, he used to say, you know, the president's hard to wake up. Let Howie wake him up. He likes Howie. Because he was. He was, you know, he slept hard. He was tough to wake up. And I went in there and I lunged on him a few times. And I finally lunged on him again. And I said, boy, I hate to do this. And he said, don't do it. Now, I got a direct order from the president of the United States. Well, I need to get him up because if I don't get him up and get ready, it's my fault, correct? That's why I said, sir, it's time to get your butt out of bed. And I don't think I said butt, ladies and gentlemen. But anyway, and it's in several books, that statement. And he got up and he was okay with that. I would never say that to any other president, but it was common language within our age group. And he felt comfortable that somebody would be doing that. And, of course, Hillary is peeking out of the covers. I said, don't you laugh, you're next, let's go. And I got him under duress, you know, people. I'm there tired, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm moving them. I got people bringing them coffee. They haven't had their coffee yet. You know, they're getting into the bathroom, and they're getting out of the bathroom, and I'm the only one with clothes on to a certain extent in there. I got to get the hairdresser out of the back. The mother-in-law was sleeping in the stateroom. Got to get her up. I got to look for some clothes. He's asking me about clothes, and I got the suitcases open. So I went out of the stateroom and went to the Secret Service. I said, where's the valet? The valet's the guy that packed the bag. See, and everything's wrapped up. I don't know where anything is. I said, where's the valet? They said, oh, the staff put him on the backup. Well, that changed. That never happened again. I need the guy there to pack the suitcase to help me. Anyway, we got through that. And I want you to know, this was a moment that I saw these two people getting along better under duress at 3 in the morning than me and my wife and my kids sometimes going to work Sunday school in the morning. That was a moment that told me a lot about the people. Okay, I want to give you one history story. This is, to me, a big one. And it says a little bit about our country. You know the old story, don't be careful what door you walk through because you may, you know, slam, you may have to walk through it again. In the early Reagan days, President Sadat from Egypt was assassinated. And President Reagan sent the backup airplane, that same airplane that President Carter sent with Miss Lillian, the same airplane. And this is the airplane that's in Dayton, Ohio, has all the history. President Kennedy's body was flown back on the airplane. We've carried Senator Dirksen on the airplane, carrying Mary Eisenhower when they passed away and things of this nature, all the history. And sent a delegation to go to Sadat's funeral. The people on the manifest, the VIP on the airplane was a gentleman named Al Haig, who's the Secretary of State. He is riding in the stateroom of the airplane with his own bathroom. In the conference area, there's Caspar Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense. In the staff area, Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon is sitting in the seat in the staff area where Mr. Haldeman used to sit. In the staff. President Ford in the working staff area. President Carter. Because these are all the people that had negotiated with President Sadat and had a relationship with him. And Henry Kissinger and Mrs. Carter in the staff area, the working staff area. They used to be the head of that airplane. The gentleman who used to work for all of them in one capacity of the other, when President Carter was President, Al Haig was the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. President Nixon, he was one of the chief of staffs in the White House. And for Ford, and for Kissinger, he was a full colonel to a two-star general. This gentleman is in the stateroom with his own bathroom. Anyway, you're going across over to Europe, and sooner or later, nature calls. And we were concerned about this protocol, but there was nothing to do because the airplane set up to fly the president, not this type of delegation. One time I was in the back and Dr. Kissinger grabbed my jacket and he said, Howie. I said, yes, sir. He said, you finally got me. I said, sir. He said, you got me in Sturridge. So they knew You know, they knew there was a protocol problem, and they weren't that happy about it, but they didn't complain or anything like that. So anyway, as we're going across the Atlantic Ocean, nature calls, and here comes President Carter. He comes up to the front of the airplane. Now, I just worked for this gentleman, for my commander-in-chief, for 4 years. And he comes up and sees me, and he says, "Howie, would you mind if I used the crew bathroom?" Now, you can imagine. "Yes, sir." And I immediately, what's going on? Well, Helen Thomas is in the back. Where he's sitting, his bathroom is in the back of the airplane. And for him to get to the bathroom, he's got to go past the press and Helen Thomas. And he didn't want to do that. So he came up to use the crew bathroom right outside the cockpit. I said, "Yes, sir," and escorted him up, and he went in. And next thing you know, here comes President Ford. And he was very nice. He asked me, you know, "Is the bathroom occupied?" I said, "Yes, sir." And I didn't tell him who was in there. And so the radio operator is sitting there in the radios, and he flew on Air Force 2 with President Ford. And President Ford and myself and the radio operator were chit-chatting, friendly conversation, the good old days and everything like that. And, you know, Jerry told him, you know, "We appreciated when you used to make the phone calls to the airplane and things of that nature." And next thing you know, here comes Henry Kissinger. Now, I got President Ford in the bathroom, the crew bathroom, and I got President Carter in the crew bathroom, President Ford waiting online. Now I got Henry Kissinger. Now, Henry Kissinger, he don't ask me. He walks right up to the bathroom, looks at the occupied sign, and comes back. And now the three of us, I mean, President Ford and Henry Kissinger and the radio operator and myself were chit-chatting. And Henry says, "You know, I got to go back and tell Cappy, Caspar Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense, that the discipline in the military is slipping." And I said, "Why is that, sir?" He said, "Because all you guys used to be scared to death of me." And then he says to me, "Who the hell's in the bathroom?" I said, "Sir, it's President Carter, and he took a book with him." Is this a moment in history, huh? Remember, Al Haig used to work for all these guys. He's got his own stateroom and his own bathroom. Okay? So, the next thing you know, we're still standing there chit-chatting, and here he comes. President Nixon. Okay? And there was a term by a lot of people, they used to call him King Richard. Off the, you know, behind the scenes. And President Nixon walked up, surveyed the situation. There was a gentleman named John Palmer, as a flight attendant on Air Force One when he was president, and he knew John. Surveyed the situation, looked at John, he said, "When it's my turn, call me." That's a moment in history, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very, very much. And thank you again for being who you are in Omaha, Nebraska. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Omaha Town Hall Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by former Chief Steward on Air Force One, Howie Franklin, who served five American presidents, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. Mr. Franklin also serves as president of the North Carolina Airport Association and as director of the Brunswick County Airport in southeastern North Carolina. He has written of his experiences in his book, "Yes, Sir, Mr. President, My Life Aboard Air Force One." This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, March 25, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Sue Mullen, Public Relations Chairman for the Omaha Town Hall Lecture Series, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.